I think you've all read my book and you found it to be the most amazing piece of Buddhist literature you've ever...
Please review it on Amazon.
So if you could, please review it on Amazon, and if you could use those exact words, I'd appreciate it.
It's on there, right?
I'm going to do a little bit of advertising shortly, and it would be great to have some positive reviews on Amazon. There's a couple up there now, which has been nice. Everybody who's talking about it said it served its purpose, which is to bring clear awareness to the Buddhist teaching. So if you found it that way, please review it. I would greatly appreciate it. If you found that it's a lot of hogwash, please keep it to yourself. If you found it's a lot of hogwash, you can put that up there too. I can deal with it.
It's not me. It's not mine.
Again, those of you who have been on retreat, remember that
there'll be a comment. Any negative comments are from deluded minds, please.
Oh, yeah. If it is a negative comment, I'll qualify it. They just didn't pay attention. At lunch, I'd like to say a few words in appreciation for everybody. So, you know, we'll stand up and maybe give the kitchen staff a little round of applause, and I'll acknowledge Karen because she really does. The back end work that Karen does frees me up greatly. She takes care of a lot of the details and allows us to have these wonderful retreats. I want to acknowledge Reverend Kim, who's the director, and her whole staff. So I'll say a little speech for that.
Short speech.
It will be. It will be short. Wow.
Rob, you know him so well.
If it, you know, it's relative. It depends on who's doing the accounting of it. So. I usually do. Unfortunately. One of the reasons why these retreats are so meaningful and full of meaning is because of these two folks. What Matt brings to our retreats, what Matt brings to our Sangha, what Matt brings to our center can't
what
be overstated.
Matt just brings.
Yeah, Matt just brings. I remember when Matt was still out in Oregon, I guess, I mentioned before, I was friends with the who owned Frenchtown Acupuncture before Matt took it over. And she was really having a hard time finding anybody. This was kind of an ongoing discussion. I used to have two sessions a week with her back then, so there was a lot of talk about this. And I interviewed this person, and they're not right, and that person, and this person. It just, nobody's right. And she was coming up against a deadline when she had to sell the building. And she came in one day, and she was just beaming. And she said, I found the perfect person. I hope he'll take it. And she was talking about that guy. And luckily for all of us, he took it. He bought it. We had a meeting a couple weeks later at the Bridge Cafe just to see if we, you know, are we going to collaborate and what we think of each other. And we sat down, we looked at each other, we said, yeah, we're gonna do this. And we had the same vision about creating just this well-focused sangha in this little town of Frenchtown, New Jersey, and what that might be like. Neither one of us knew what might take place, but what has developed is exactly what we thought about. And we mentioned, I'll get to you in a little bit. Don't be so concerned that I'm going to leave you out.
I didn't do anything. More is
a big part of this story as we go along. One of the things that we talked about and did. And the reason why I brought Maura up just now is Maura and I had talked about this before, was this idea of a Dana dinner where the whole community comes together. And 7 weeks after we had our first session at the new place with all of us together, we had our first Dana dinner. And the seventh or the eighth one is coming up.
The eighth one's coming up this
Tuesday of Thanksgiving week of this year. And those of you that have been there know what a remarkable community event. And it's all supported first by Matt's input and his steadiness, and then by all of us. And that's an event that has touched so many people in town who have no interest at all in meditation or Buddhism, and that's as it should be too.
Or don't even know that the Sangha is there.
Some people don't even, they come to the dinner and they don't even know that there's such a thing as a meditation center or a Qigong center. And again, it doesn't matter. The point of the dinner is that we come together and we share our mindful presence with everyone, and it works. And there's so many wonderful stories that have come out of that that I've heard over the years of people that were we live in a seemingly very wealthy area, and it is, but there's a lot of people in need, and this one dinner once a year serves that need, even if it's only for that one night. So again, the next dinner's November 21st, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. All the way back to the beginning, when I first started a meditation center, and I just said that erroneously, when we first started, Moore was a big part of that, and it can't be overstated that if it wasn't for Moore's contribution from the beginning and over the years, there wouldn't be a center either. You know, both of them are as responsible for the center as the teacher. I couldn't have done it without their support. And nothing significant in the world gets done singularly. Even the Buddha needed his Sangha in order to continue his work. So, thank you. You've both bring so much to our retreat. I mean, just think about it. I'm not being silly about this. Think about the retreat without those two. I wouldn't want to be here. I don't know if you'd want to be here. I wouldn't want to be here. So thank you so much. And then to all of you, when I'm talking about my dog, I don't mean to compare you to my dog. When I talk about my dog, I usually say something like this, that he's the best dog I ever had. And I really think that. But I've thought that about every dog I've ever had. Whatever your current dog is, you think it's the best. I think you dogs are the best. But I really do. And I think it has to do with the progression of all of our understanding of the Dhamma. And it's really remarkable what takes place here in just a couple of days. And so I want to thank you for letting me be part of your Sangha, because, boy, I am so fortunate that that's taken place. It's so great to have someone like Carrie, who's just joined us, that Tracy can come from Salt Lake City. We so look forward to, when I said Tracy's coming, everybody's excited. Wow, we get to see Tracy again. So thank you for making the trip. I know it's not easy. It's going to be even more difficult for you, but I hope you take the plane into her Tuesday night Sangha too. And Larry, I said it last night, but it's so great to have you as part of our Sangha. We're also appreciative that you've joined us. And I hope to see you. The Donna dinner would be a great time to meet your wife, by the way. We wouldn't be sitting here right now if it wasn't for our timekeeper. Thank you so much, Kevin. You've really done an outstanding job, even at 6:30 in the morning when I heard a few things.
6:25.
Thank you.
Not many people who wake you up in the morning get applause.
And he brews a nice cup of coffee too.
And then there's people here that wanted to be here and couldn't, that are part of our Sangha. We all acknowledge Frank and what an important part he is of our Sangha. There's a few other folks, Mary and Debbie, who come on Saturday religiously. Eva, who's been coming for years and years. She started coming when we were in Eaglesville on one of these nights
Thursday
of the week.
Nights.
That was Thursday night?
Thursday nights, yeah.
And that's the name Cross River, by the way. That's where it came from.
Two
sides of the river. Some new folks like Tim. What were you going to say?
No, never mind.
Tim,
you
been...
had the Cross River name before we had the Regalsville spot.
I don't think so.
That was you and Jan.
It was Jan is the one that came up with it.
Yeah.
And came up with that first the poster we used to put out. The street sign. Tim has been a great addition to our Sangha. This group that I'll mention now all came on the same time. Oh, Bonnie. How could we forget Bonnie?
And Diane.
Diane's taking care of Bodhi. You know, somebody's got to watch it. The most important person in the world. What?
Laura, Matt's
wife. This group all came on one Thursday night. I mentioned Tim. Isabella and Nash, and Isabella's mother and father, all came on this one night, and they've continued to come. And Jen has, I mean, we really miss her, don't we?
Yeah.
And Anthony Murgatroyd.
Heavens to Murgatroyd.
So, and I know I'm leaving a few. Allie, who's new. Allie and Olivia. Olivia brought her sister, and she was saying last Tuesday or Thursday night, I get them mixed up now. She's looking forward to bringing her mother and her other sisters. So it really is remarkable what's developed there, isn't it? When you look at it in totality, what's developed. Who?
Bonnie.
Yeah.
Greg.
Yeah, Greg. Greg Ogden. Yeah. Did he get a hold of you, Mary Beth? You guys?
No, not yet.
Okay, yeah. And that's the other thing, you know, our ongoing Donna project is going to be the Rare Art and Learning Cooperative, which is such an incredible idea that we get to be a part of, because we have a real Sangha, you know, a well-focused Sangha. So, again, I'm just so honored to be a part of your Sangha. And if I left anybody out, they're still a part of this whole thing. There is, as usual, there's a lot that I'd like to get to in the hour we have left, but somewhat quickly, I'd like to hear from at least a few of you your experience of living the last 3.5 days within the framework of the Eightfold Path, and particularly Right Speech. So, anybody want to talk about that a little bit? Yes, Larry.
Yeah, I'm very moved by that. Incredible for me to be here with all of you, and you know, I think I have a good sense, and I sense this would be the case, which is why I'm here, and I'm so, one of the reasons I think I had a good sense here was this: you keep apologizing sometimes for, you know, pointing out maybe the shortcomings of this or that, or the confusion of this and that. But I appreciate that very much, because that's my experience. And even a simple thing as the Four Noble Truths, many translations, they have different ways of expressing them or even labeling them. And, you know, the one that is used here is Right View. Right intention. And, you know, I've been more familiar with right understanding and right thought. And it means the same. It's semantics, perhaps, but it's not always the case. And so, I said, when I think someone asked me when I first arrived, maybe it was you, John, but, you know, why are you here or something like that, and I thought, I just sort of glibly said, because I think I started knowing all this, and, you know, I thought maybe it was better when I start getting into knowing, it's time for me to go look a little deeper. And but I do know. I do know a lot about this, and I have been with it for some time. But there's a difference between, you know, just knowing something, of course, and or understanding it, and having a deeper or more clarity, as I've said before, but oftentimes it's more aptly described, I think, as penetrating. And so this Sangha here has really helped me to penetrate these teachings more deeply. That's for sure. And and so I just want to thank everyone here. And, you know, I think that your guidance, your skill, at communicating these teachings,
Thank you, Larry. I need a moment. The Buddha talks about what that kind of knowledge that you're talking about is, penetrating knowledge. You penetrate it to the heart of it. It's not just the surface experience. And the framework of the Eightfold Path gives us that penetrating knowledge. And, I do think I'm a pretty good teacher, and I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I learned how to teach by reading how the Buddha taught. And so if any skills I've developed are his skills. And when I talk about a true lineage, that's what I mean. You know, if I was teaching John Haspel's Dhamma, hopefully none of you would be here to listen to that nonsense. But one of the reasons why I decided a long time ago that if I'm going to teach, I should only teach what I can find in the Pali Canon, because that's the only way that I can know that it came from an awakened human being. And I think that's what it's proven to work. So, but also, thank you, Larry, for pointing that out. Anybody else about... well, let's start. Anybody else about how wonderful I am? And then we'll talk about that. About the framework of the Eightfold Path. And again, I want to get to at least one sutta this morning, and Mary Beth, you had your hand up?
Oh, just to say you're wonderful.
Thank you.
No, I really do. I live three blocks from, you know, this, like, how fortunate am I, you know? And I've been involved in different ways in understanding, you know, Buddhism and other, you know, somewhat related stuff for like 15 years, but to find this,
I agree. It's never lost on me how remarkable, somewhat unique, and how fortunate we all are that there it is in that little town of Frenchtown, middle of nowhere.
I'd like to just say a couple things.
Please don't make it about me. I'm serious. I've heard it. I've had enough. This. I'm sorry. Please. An aspect of the Dhamma is being able to receive, and I realized right then I wasn't receiving graciously, so I'm sorry.
It's really neat what happens when we all come together on retreat, and there's both an external renunciation that happens and an internal renunciation that happens, and to me what that looks like is, externally we're leaving our world, we're leaving our routine, and we're coming together in a place, you know, we're not connected in the ways that we were to our daily life, we're not thinking about all those things that we're in our daily life, and we're not living like we do in our daily lives to a certain degree, except for maybe Ram. That's sort of the external part. The internal part, what happens is we all sort of let our guards down and let go of these aspects of our persona that keep us individuals in the outer world, and we let those go and we come together as a Sangha for the very specific purpose of awakening and hearing the Dhamma and taking to the Dhamma and having our lives for this 4 days framed by the Dhamma. This is something that's been going on in humanity for a long time, and we're doing that, and not all of humanity has been coming together in that way for a long time. It just doesn't always work that way. But to have a group like this to come together and do that, committed to practicing restraint in that way of renunciation, it's just so amazing. I love it. It warms my heart, and thank you, John. You know, it's really, thank you, Maura. It's awesome. Thank you, guys. You know, outside of here, being on retreat back in our lives, you know, I know what this practice has done for me and my family, my wife and my children. It's just it means a lot.
Yeah.
It just gets you like that sometimes, doesn't it?
It does.
So you said something. I said a lot of wonderful things, but that part about we all feel safe or secure with each other, that's the essence of taking true refuge. That's what the Ratana Sutta is all about, the three jewels, the three refuges. We've taken true refuge in the Buddha, and the awakened human being did this, and he left his teachings. And because of that, the environment is naturally safe, isn't it? And one of the things that I can't help noticing is how remarkable it is how you all just join together, whether it's individually, one-on-one, and I can, you know, I'm not overhearing the conversations, but you can tell that they're just meaningful aspects of right speech, and I guess every one of you would agree with that. That's remarkable. That's true refuge. Again, I'm going to try not to talk, but that's not going to work out too well. Anybody else? Kevin?
You have a chapter at the end of The Truth of Happiness that's one of the most inspirational things I think I've ever read that you wrote. It talks about the true lineage of the Dhamma, and I think, you know, I'm turning this around on you again. I'm going to pay you a compliment because I don't think it can be understated enough, your commitment to the teachings, to the integrity of the teachings, to preserving those, and the way you wrote that in that book, when I first read that, it you know, I welled up pretty good because it said, you know, now there's a true spirit. The Dhamma is inside every one of us, and
yeah,
we've all gone forth, as Matt just said, from our daily lives, and come here to develop this understanding together. And I think we're all entering the stream, or, you know, getting in there pretty good, knee deep.
Yeah.
You know, now we can go forth to the world and really do what the Buddha describes, experience the Dhamma in our daily lives, and offer it to others. And that's sort of that embodiment as the greatest offering that we have of this truth. You know, I mean, that was my last one. I could sit and get an autograph somebody's book on that, but discovering the truth is life's greatest adventure. Understanding that truth through you is life's greatest gift. Now embodying that truth is life's greatest offering. And I just have to thank you, John, and thank the Sangha, all of you.
Yeah. Thank you, and again, thank you all. That the true lineage of the Dhamma living here, and being able to experience it, is the most remarkable thing. You know, it's still here. It's an ordinary experience based on extraordinary teachings. Anybody else before we get going?
I'll say something.
Please.
You know, we grew up in a family of words. Everyone in my family is interested in words and their meaning, what you can do with them and how you can play with them and all. And so I was thinking about, you know, right speech, right view, the whole right. And there's the other form of right, W-R-I-T-E, which comes from the word wrought, as in wrought iron, as in worked.
Mm.
And I sort of think that that applies here too, because you really have to work at it, and you meld it and form it, and you make it your own.
Yeah.
And so when I'm really working it, that's what I'm thinking about, that I'm melding it, I'm making it a structure that's part of me, that I can carry, that I can be present with, that hopefully other people can see.
Yeah. Thank you, Helen. The framework is very specific for every single person, but we make it personal, don't we?
Yes.
Not in a negative way. We personalize it because we use it in a way to encounter our own conditioned thinking. And it works remarkably well. Maura?
Yeah. So one just small reflection that I had is often on retreats, and I listen to Dhamma talks, and I hear people say, oh, how do I carry this forth into my life? Like, that's a common refrain.
Yeah.
Like, how to, oh, I know I've got to go back.
That's the best part.
But that's, well, that's precisely what, you know, I was reflecting. Like, there's no sense of how do I take this into my life, because we're not taking anything. There's the framework of the Eightfold Path that is carrying us forth into the world. So we're not holding on to peace and a still mind and, you know, clinging and craving onto all that stuff. It's a momentum of deeper understanding. It's very clear how the transitions are made, and like, is there really even a transition? You know, like, in one way there is, but there isn't. Yeah. So that's all. I wanted just to acknowledge that in terms of the structure of this type of retreat and the deeper beneficial aspects of that.
Thank you. More, could you, I'm sorry to keep making you move. No, this time to your left, just a little bit. A little bit more. No, to your left. That left.
How's that?
Good. Now I can see Helen. Larry, please.
No, I just, with Maura said that. I don't know, I think maybe it was Mark Epstein who said this, which I was 11. Maybe you've heard it before, but. You know, when I tell my parents I'm a Buddhist, it drives them crazy. But when I'm a Buddha, no one seems to mind.
Thank you. You said such a great thing. I'm going to probably extract your sayings on the recording and put a separate thing with Larry's sayings on the screen. Bit more was talking about we know how to take this practice now. We integrate the Eightfold Path into our lives. That's really how it is. It's integral to our lives. And that's why, if you notice in the translations, my translation from the holy life is to the integrated life, because it's much more direct into what we're actually doing. Carrie, I put you on the spot a few times, and it's perfectly okay to say no comment. You've had enough, and that we really would understand that. But I really like to hear, if you're comfortable with it, how you feel about, because you mentioned it a little bit yesterday, about being able to take what you've learned here and integrate it here back home with you.
I know a couple people, I've talked to them about it, and I don't want to say it makes me nervous. I don't have anyone in my life that supports it at this point, except for Jesus. So I'm glad that I'm not leaving here.
Mm.
You're still with me, you know, mm-hmm. Tuesdays, Thursdays.
that's right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I didn't see it right away. I just really felt like, you know, I'm leaving this, I'm going back to everything I kind of took refuge from, but I'm not leaving you yet. Or at all, hopefully.
You can't. Thank you. How many people can relate to not having someone in their life that's into the Buddha's teaching? Well, I can't anymore. So I think it was just about everyone, wasn't it? That's just the way it is. And we're fortunate that we have it. And we're able to, I think each and every one of us, I don't know, Mary's story is really amazing, the influence that she's had on her husband, even though he had an interest anyway. But I think we've all had a, and I use this word very loosely, a positive influence on those around us, haven't we? And not necessarily trying to convert them, just by living the Dhamma. So.
Being the Buddha instead of talking about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So glad you joined us. Okay, I better get to it if we're going to get to one sutta anyway. The Kakaya Yanagata Sutta really encapsulates, synopsizes everything we've talked about so far. So why am I going over it again? Repetition. The Buddha consistently described an awakened human being as an arahant, as unbound or released from clinging. Due to ignorance, self-referential identities are created by clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas. The Buddha never taught that all things are interdependent, interconnected, or interbe. These are conceptual strategies of continued eye-making rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The notion of a grand cosmic oneness was consistently dismissed by the Buddha as a thicket of views that do not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, or to calm, direct knowledge, to full awakening, or to unbinding. That's from the Majjhima Nikaya. The Eightfold Path develops the compassion and wisdom to free all beings from clinging to the world by freeing oneself from clinging to wrong views. The Kakaya Yanagata Sutta is a teaching on right view and also a clear explanation of the common misunderstandings of emptiness and non-duality. The common applications of emptiness and non-duality are extreme or wrong views of existence and non-existence. These continued wrong views create a doctrine, a deluded doctrine of emptiness and non-duality by fixating on these views as if they are the only possible views. When the Buddhist teachings are fully developed, it is clear that all things in the impermanent phenomenal world are discrete in a very practical sense. So the idea of a conceptual realm of emptiness, or the conceptual realm of all, of a non-duality reality, are simply strategies that a self-referential ego self creates to fill a void in its understanding. In other words, well, if this isn't self, then there's got to be some place to establish me in. So I'll establish me in this void of emptiness, or I'll establish me in this idea of a non-duality means, which means all things are reconcilable to one thing. And both of those, if you look at them closely, are just another strategy to establish a self somewhere, to accommodate for what's not, as the Buddha would say, there's nothing beyond this, to accommodate for that beyondness. Where do I put myself? We had a great talk about that earlier. How do I continue to establish myself? Well, the point is to not. The Kakaya Yanagata...
That was a short discussion.
I guess that's enough. We're done. Thank you for a wonderful retreat.
Just let that be enough.
I should have the sense to let that be enough, shouldn't I? But I won't. Notice that there is nothing in the direct teachings of dependent origination that would imply a doctrine of... Did I just say that? I think I did. No, I didn't. Mm. Notice that there is nothing in the direct teachings of dependent origination that would imply a doctrine of interdependence, interconnectedness, or interbeing. The reason why I'm saying that is it's the change to independent origination, really the dismissal of what the Buddha actually taught, that allows for something called interdependence. The two words, even though they have the same, the root word, mean two different things, don't they? Dependent doesn't in any way even imply interdependence, except the word has been hijacked to say the Buddha taught a doctrine of interdependence, and then leading to interconnectedness and interbeing. These non-dual teachings rooted in ignorance and wrong view. These are non-dual teachings rooted in ignorance and wrong view. In this sutta, the world is metaphor for confused and deluded views that result in unsatisfactory experiences or dukkha. And so look at how the world has supported these continued wrong views. The insistence on a non-dual doctrine obscures reality and contradicts right view in the entire Eightfold Path. As seen here, the Buddha shows that a non-dual doctrine is an extreme or wrong view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha was again staying at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. The monk Kakaya Yanagata approached the Buddha with a question. I don't understand right view. Can you teach me how right view relates to the world? Kakayana, the confusion and deluded thinking in the world arises from polarizing views. There is the view of a permanent existence and a view of a permanent non-existence. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view, it is seen that, and I wrote in the word nihilistic, from right view it is seen that nihilistic non-existence does not occur. I read it again. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, right? So the reason why I'm making an emphasis on that point is when we gain an understanding, we can start holding on to that. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, we got to be willing to go that next step. The arising and the passing away is abandoned from right view. It is seen that non-existence does not occur. Mark and I had a really great discussion about what happens beyond. What happens when I awake? What happens when I die an awakened being and there's nothing causing a future birth?
Why worry?
You're awakened. there's nothing beyond. Why would we possibly want to consider something beyond awakening?
Well, the only alternative is to be awakened, to be reborn, and be in confusion again. So the benefit of awakening and dying is that's the end. That's the end of the process. That's the benefit.
Yeah, the Buddha said repeatedly, even the very first thing he said was, for me, you'll touch the ground. For me, there'll be no more births. And he said that repeatedly.
And births, meaning he will not arise, a self will not arise within that existence, however long that.
Yeah,
the entire mass is
In this sutta, the Buddha is referring to being in the world is dukkha. It's when you take it to that ultimate level, it's not even the ultimate level, the realistic level, the world is prone to suffering. Why? Because of the impermanent nature of all things. Let me get back to the sutta.
And rebirth is caused by confusion. So at the end of confusion,
there's no more rebirth.
Yes. I always like to go back just to keep it in context. Kakayana, the continued and deluded thinking in the world arises from polarizing view. There is the view of a permanent existence and a view of a permanent non-existence. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view, it is seen that non-existence does not occur. Maybe that's why it takes me so long to get through this, because I read it over and over again. Furthermore, when the cessation of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view, it is understood that permanent existence does not occur, meaning the permanent establishment of a self through eons, a soul that migrates, transmigrates, whatever the word you want to use, forever. The world is sustained by attachments, by clinging to conditioned thinking and wrong views, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The world is sustained by attachments and wrong views.
The world.
The world. And again, there's no judgment in that. It's just a statement of truth. The world is sustained by wrong views. On a worldly, global, cosmic level, the world is sustained on wrong views. On an individual level, our world, our relationship, our place in the world, if rooted in wrong views, is sustained by those wrong views.
Delight.
And the only way to sustain our world is to continue with wrong views. And that's why we create these infinite strategies to continue to do it, which the Buddha is addressing here directly. One who has developed right view no longer clings to attachments or fixed, meaning conditioned thinking, or self-obsession. Self-obsession. One who has developed right view no longer clings to self-obsession. We've let go the need to continually be obsessed with establishing the self moment by moment in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. It is understood that stress arising is simply stress arising. What a beautiful line. I think you all feel the peace in that line, don't you? We understand that stress arising is simply stress arising. It is also understood that stress passing away is stress passing away. When that last piece of chocolate cake is gone, it's gone. No big deal. When the retreat's over, it's over. No! It is understood that stress passing away is stress passing away. In this, their knowledge is independent of other views. Another important line. It's a view that has arisen independently of other views. The Buddha was speaking at a time when even the members of that Sangha were inadvertently and maybe sometimes directly clinging. Their thinking wasn't independent of other views. In this way, their knowledge is independent of other views. This is how right view relates to the world. The view that everything exists is a wrong view, and the view that nothing exists is another wrong view. My Dhamma avoids extreme views. I teach from the middle. I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. That one line there shows what I mean when I say that the Eightfold Path is the framework for our mindfulness. It avoids extreme views when we are able, through a well-concentrated mind, to evaluate things, whether it fits within this framework or not. And if it doesn't, we simply abandon it or discard it. Or what was the word you used last night, Larry? Annihilate?
What is made? From the poem?
Yeah.
Maybe that was another one, but yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
What's on your rock?
Annihilate.
Yeah.
So it works. We were talking about severing and annihilating and destroying.
Cutting it off.
That's often another.
The root.
Let's do all this.
Cut it off at the root. Yeah, let's do it.
Get to the root.
I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. That's why there's so much freedom within the Eightfold Path. Because when we're living our lives within that framework, we know that we're free of extreme views. And in a very practical way, I also know that I'm not going to express or insist on an extreme view when I'm talking to anyone. I'm looking at Kevin. I'm not going to insist that I have an extreme view that you must agree to, because I don't have an extreme view to defend. The Buddha continues, the middle way shows that suffering originates and is dependent on ignorance. How can anybody get that wrong? You have heard this before, but you're going to hear it again. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths, I put that in there. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths, as a requisite condition, comes fabrications. Ignorance is required for fabrications and everything that follows. From fabrications, as a requisite condition, comes consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. From consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form, self-identification. From name and form, as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, a required condition, comes contact. It's obvious, isn't it? But remember, in the context of what we're talking about, now the sixth sense base is there only for an opportunity to continue defilements, thinking rooted in ignorance. Because it's originating in ignorance, the sixth sense base, which are normally impersonal, have now become personal. They're self-referential. And they're there to continue to reaffirm self-referential views. From the sixth sense base, as a required condition, comes contact. From contact, as a required condition, comes feeling. I bet you that's very obvious to every one of you now, isn't it? We need to have contact if we're going to have feeling. And if that contact is rooted in ignorance, the feeling is a feeling that is rooted in ignorance itself. Everybody gets that, I think, right? It's really simple and direct when you see it in the proper context. Even though this is a sutta, Ananda was saying one day to the Buddha, I got dependent origination. Nothing. The Buddha says, not yet. It's very deep. It's very profound. But it's not beyond us. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Do I need to go back?
No.
Okay. Just from this point forward. Well, I will. I mean, I get excited. I think I probably read fast anyway. I took Evelyn Woods when I was 8 years old, and I haven't gotten rid of it. It still conditioned my mind. From contact, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. Does everybody know who Evelyn Woods is?
Yes.
that's quite a...
Speed reading?
Yeah, Evelyn Woods speed reading. It really worked. I can tell you, it's just the most amazing.
It's like that.
It affects your speech too, though, unfortunately.
Try putting John on the iPhone where you can speed up the sound.
Yeah, I guess I was born. Is everybody 78 RPM? Nobody knows the reference to that.
Yeah.
From feeling, as a requisite condition, comes craving. Anything that impacts through those senses that I've self-identified with, I want more of it. And I want more of it until it kills me, and it almost did a few times. And we do that. We do that with anything that we create an identity with. Sometimes it doesn't rise to the level of addiction, but there's always an underlying compulsion there once we've attached ourselves to things. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging... What's that? From craving as a requisite condition, a required condition, comes clinging and maintaining. So if you don't want to cling or maintain that, what do? Avoid craving. And if you can't quite avoid craving, what do? You look at your sixth sense base. And if you can't quite do that, look at your conditioned thinking, your consciousness. And if you can't quite do that, look at the assumptions you've made about yourself and the world around you. And if you can't quite do that, just accept that you're ignorant. And you can take it from there.
Return your mindfulness to the sensation of
breathing. Just return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing.
Be gentle with yourself.
From clinging and maintaining as a required, a requisite condition, comes becoming. Becoming what?
Ignorant.
Or?
Awakened.
Hence the name of the book. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. And from that birth, rooted in ignorance, as a required or a requisite condition, comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Such is the origination of extreme views and the entire mass of confusion, delusion, and suffering. In all his great wisdom and compassion, he doesn't leave us there, does he? Now, the Buddha says, from the remainderless fading and cessation of that very ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness or conditioned thinking. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form, self-referential views. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming, more ignorant. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering. In a few very short words, the Buddha's described the problem and the solution. Really remarkable, isn't it? That's dependent origination.
Could you just leave that last line again, please?
Of course. I'll read the last section of that and then the last. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering. Now this, monks, is a noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are all stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. Such a simple thing, but yet it took an awakened human being to point out how craving after things is so stressful and the problem. In short, he almost always concludes this description of dukkha, of stress, this way. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. The five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of ongoing suffering. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight. I love this line. Relishing now here and now there. And for example, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, even if it's for becoming more ignorant, craving for becoming. And then craving for non-becoming, rooted in self-loathing. Look at what I've become. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release and the letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress, precisely this noble eightfold path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. That's the end of the sutta. Thank you.
Can I ask, non-becoming, can it also be seen as non-becoming as a form of just like simple aversion too? So becoming confused, becoming sad. So non-becoming is is not wanting to become that, in a sense, let's just say, or no?
You can look at it that way. In fact, I wouldn't say that the Buddha is not inferring it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the...
Because it's like a not wanting whatever is it, you, the self has decided, you know, has clung to, and
yes,
now doesn't want it, and so it's a not, because to me that's almost like a more common experience of the clinging aggregates rather than a kind of further down the line is this glumping of, oh, now I'm a terrible person. But it starts at that very low level.
Yeah.
Of
that's the formation of it. And it also, it's a really good way of looking at it too. The non-becoming is speaking to the deluded notion of emptiness and non-duality, because a doctrine of non-duality is a way of establishing a self in literally nothing. There's no, and there's been, the Buddha noticed a strong desire for that idea, and the emptiness idea, not as emptiness of ignorance, but the emptiness as an environment to establish oneself in, which was rooted in the Vedas.
Mm-hmm.
That was,
mm-hmm,
it's a common theme in the Vedas and and later the Upanishads, that type of non-dualistic thinking. And that's what he's referring directly to that.
Yeah, so can you just go a little farther on that one? It's the first time in this, I think, in my experience here, where that was introduced as non-dual.
Oh.
And it implies that there is, or dual.
Actually, it doesn't.
I'm just slightly confused on that.
Thank you for bringing it up. The Buddha saying that non-duality is a wrong view does not imply that, okay, then duality must be. Look for the, and again, this is not directed at you. The mind wants to create some place to find repose, to establish itself. So if it's not non-duality, well, there's got to be duality, and how can I fit myself in there? The Buddha didn't teach a non-dual or a dualistic reality or truth. He taught to see everything in its discreteness. And if you think about the common push, I would say compulsion, to reconcile everything into kind of one thing, it's the antithesis of seeing everything discreetly. Everything that arises in the world is subject to cessation and comes to cessation discreetly. There's common functions that can cloud that to saying, well, because everything occurs in a basic manner, well, then there's non-duality. But that clouds the Dhamma. It's not a non-dual Dhamma, and it's not a dualistic Dhamma. It's an everything is allowed Dhamma. That's the first time I've ever said that. Everything that we, in order to understand the Dhamma, you have to see everything in its discreteness, not in its not in its connection.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the connection that we try to form that clouds what's really occurring.
So when someone says, as frequently, this is perhaps the best example of it in common, you know, worldly associations, you know, when people are talking about right and wrong, and someone will sit there and say, oh, that's just dualistic thinking.
Yeah, that's thrown out a lot.
And that's the implications, that's not good thinking.
Yeah.
And what I think I hear you saying, or the Buddha has said here, is that there are all these separate factors, and one's not necessarily more important than the other.
Yes,
but they have to be looked at separately.
They have to be. Yes, if you're going to see it clearly, you have to. Another, you know, maybe this is a simple way of saying it. In order to see things clearly, you have to stop putting labels on them. Any labels, because any label is an attempt to fit something into a view, isn't it?
Well,
see,
I mean,
things
that,
in there.
Bear with me here just for a second. Cause I'm really feeling like I'm going to get right through here, because me and my quoting here. So I read something that resonates and I hold on to it and I think that's something good. And one was from Kabir, this mystic poet, who said, "Behold the One in all things."
Yeah.
The second will lead you astray. And as I read it, the second thing was that you're you don't have any hair, I have hair. You're a Democrat, I'm a Republican. you're a Jew, I'm a Muslim, you know, and this is the cause of great suffering, is this labeling. So just don't go there. Don't go there. Behold the one in all things. And in his case, he capitalized one, which has other implications. So there was for me this sense of, oh yeah, I like that makes sense to me. And so, and maybe it still should make sense to me, but how is it in the context of what the Buddha taught?
Here's the problem with that. In the world, there are Jews, and there are Muslims, and there's black people and white people, and there's smart people and not so smart people, and there's short and tall people. Trying to say, well, they're all the same thing is just simply not reality, and it creates great tension in our minds. And that view, I think, creates more tension than the intolerance that comes from wrong labels, even though we shouldn't have labels. The truth of the matter is, a clear mind, resting in the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, recognizes that there's Jews and Muslims and Catholics, etc., as part of the infinite experience of a human life. And none of them is more significant or insignificant than anything. And the reason why is not because of a legislative view, meaning something that we've created to live well in society. It's simply the way things are.
It's like Animal Farm.
That's
animals are created equal. The pigs are created more equal.
Yeah. And so we've created. Well, Tracy, I want to hear what you have to say, please.
Well, I was just thinking about one of the things I remember reading and studying from your and the Buddhist thoughts on impermanence was the idea of one of the reasons we suffer is because of this separation disappointment.
Yes. Exactly.
We are separate.
Yeah,
and that causes great pain.
Yeah, and we create separation by all these notions, including if you think about the implications of even something like non-duality, which attempts to include everything, is rooted in the idea that we're not. And so the underlying belief
is ignorant,
mm-hmm. and that's what creates. I know I've said this a few times, and I can't help but notice sometimes the feedback that I think the main reason for all the religious violence in the world today is not because of intolerance; it's because we're insisting to people that don't want to accept it that all religions are basically the same. And if you think, even if it's a deluded view, if I believe that my religion is the most pure and the most wonderful and the one that everybody should believe in. And the feeling in the world is I'm just like the other religions. That's intolerant to me, to my point of view. Better that we should say that all religions aren't one. All religions are wonderful for the people to practice it, and we should honor that. That's a completely tolerant view. And it gets to this idea of we need to reconcile everything into one big hump. Was that the wrong word? One big lump. And that we're all... I'm gonna try to get past that as quickly as possible. Maury's not gonna let me. We're not all one.
What's underneath the turtles? More turtles. Turtles all the way down.
Uh-oh. When Maury starts laughing, all is lost. So there's some paradoxes in this that maybe you're all even thinking about. We have come together as one Sangha. But each and every one of us would understand in this moment that we're discrete in that unity, aren't we?
Because we do the work.
And even Helen described it too. The way Helen is integrating the Dhamma is, even if it's slightly different, it's still different than the way Maura is, or I am, or any of us are. There's uniqueness in this grand thing, and that's really what should be honored, not to try to create some doctrine that doesn't exist, to satisfy the fear that arises from delight.
Yes, over the great sweep of time, go back, I don't know, 3,000 years. In the human, there is a consistent thread throughout all the teachings that there's an effort towards this unity consciousness idea. That,
yeah.
That you know, it's expressed perhaps differently, even culminating in more scientific recent history where some fella tried to prove the unified field theory.
Yeah.
I mean, that everything...
failed.
Is, yeah, it failed, but it persists. It persists, and there's something that it's sort of... And I see this now so much more clearly, this I-making thing, of this, which is so incredibly great because... It has always sort of, you know, perplexed me and confused me because there's great appeal in that.
There is.
That there's this unity.
Yeah.
And it relieves us of personal responsibility.
Well, of course it is. If we're all one part of this grand cosmic vehicle, I don't really have any responsibility for anything, do I? Especially to awaken. Because now I'm in agreement with this idea that everything is one thing. Rather than take responsibility to get off my ass and awaken, to see things clearly. Because I'm in agreement with everyone, I think that, yeah, everybody's right. There's no dichotomy anywhere, non-duality thinking. I don't even have to have a considerate next thought, do I? I can live my life as a babbling idiot because it doesn't matter. We're all the same.
You think
there's no discretion.
The Rahula Sutta, like so much, you know, here he's just explaining to a young kid like this basic thing about reflecting on one's actions and you know, like there's a very specific way from the doctrine that we gauge what's happening.
Yeah, that more is referring to the Rahula Vada Sutta, where the Buddha's teaching his 7-year-old son the Dhamma and mindfulness, but in a very direct way that a 7-year-old can understand it. You have to be authentic in the world. And that a 7-year-old or a 70-year-old can understand that, can't they? You have to be authentic in the world. He uses the analogy, he caught Rahula, obviously, in a lie. And he uses these beautiful analogies to show Rahula, you can't live your life like that. You have to be authentic in the world. Which, you know, really might be a good way to end this retreat, huh? We have to be authentic in the world. But I don't mean to end it right there. If there's any more questions, we have a little time.
I just want to thank everybody. That was a 5-chuckle moment.
That's right. You know what? I'm never done, am I? The last sutta was going to be on the Kalama Sutta. It's actually the last sutta in the book, too. And I'm going to just read a little bit of it. But I encourage you when you get home tonight or tomorrow to read it because, like all suttas, it's significant and important, but it really is a particularly important one. So just give me a moment to bring it up, like they all are. They're all, you really can't take one out, but
like
I always do.
They're all special.
So this is a sutta, the Kalama Sutta, that's often used. I mean, it's amazing to me how often someone will say the Buddha. Someone we mentioned earlier, in fact, but I don't want to re-mention names. It sounds like I'm beating the poor gentleman up. Recently, put an article out saying that the Kalama Sutta says that if we basically, I'm paraphrasing his words, but basically, if we don't like what the Buddha taught, that we should change it to fit our views, which is the essence of wrong views. And there's a line in here where the Buddha says that was misinterpreted, and I hear it all the time because I spend too much time looking at what other people are saying about Buddhism. They insist the Buddha said to question everything, and if we don't like what he's saying, we should do something else. How foolish can you be? Here's an awakened human being that spent 45 years of his life teaching a consistent Dhamma, but he said if you don't like it, just dismiss it. Foolish. And again, I'm not going to read the whole article, and probably not the whole sutta, but...
Well, people don't have the opportunity to hear the true Dhamma.
Well, he says that here. So I'm getting into a little bit of it. Well, I don't like to take things out of context for obvious reasons. How are we to know which is useful and which is effective Dhamma and which is not? The Buddha replies, of course you are uncertain and filled with doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty will follow. Do not go by reports or legends or traditions or scripture or conjecture or inference or analogies, and this is to me is the most important line, or common agreement or unexamined loyalty. loyalty to maybe a teacher who's not teaching something that's worth teaching. When you know from your own experience that the qualities taught are unskillful, shameful, confusing, and distracting, these teachings should be abandoned. There's no equivocation in the Buddha's words. He's not he's being compassionate in being direct, isn't he? He's not saying, that's okay, you know, they mean well. Because that's the epitome of cruelty, isn't it? Not willing, when you know the truth, not willing to take a stand for it. It would be cruel to do otherwise. When these teachings are criticized by the wise, they should be abandoned. Meaning someone who knows what they're talking about and says, no, that's not it. Listen to them. When these teachings lead to harm and suffering, they should be abandoned. And I can't help but get on a little bit of a rant here. There's Buddhist organizations that are led by teachers that we know are teaching a Dhamma that is a false Dhamma. How do we know it? Because of their behavior. There's teachers out there that have been raping little boys and raping little girls and sleeping with their students and giving Dhamma talks while they're obviously inebriated, and people think that's wonderful. And again, I know you can feel the rant in me. That's the time when you know that they're teaching a false Dhamma. Look at the behavior. You know, and that's when we should stop support of it. That's the end of the rant, I hope. I have to go back. When these teachings are criticized by the wise, they should be abandoned. When these teachings lead to harm and suffering, they should be abandoned. Everybody agrees with that, don't you? What do you think, Kalamas? When the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking arise in a person, do they arise for benefit or for harm? The defilements always bring harm. And when a person is driven by the defilements, their mind possessed, they kill other beings, they take what is not given, they take another spouse, they lie and induce others to lie, all of which create long-term harm and suffering for themselves and others. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these defilements skillful or unskillful, shameful or shameless, criticized or praised by the wise? The defilements are always unskillful, shameful, and criticized by the wise. The reason why that's important is it's okay to call a horse a horse. In fact, it's required. When the defilements are acted upon, do they lead to long-term suffering for oneself and others or not? They always lead to long-term suffering for self and others. So, as I said, do not go by reports or legends or traditions or scripture or conjecture or inference or analogies or common agreement or unexamined loyalty. When you know from your own experience that the qualities taught are unskillful, shameful, confusing, and distracting, these teachings should be abandoned. When these teachings are criticized by the wise, they should be abandoned. When these teachings lead to harm and suffering, they should be abandoned. Now, do not go by reports or legends or traditions or scripture or conjecture or inference or analogies or common agreement or unexamined loyalty. When you know from your own experience that the qualities taught are skillful, shameless, unambiguous, direct, these teachings should be developed. Do you know that these teachings are shameless and direct and unambiguous? Mm-hmm. Then they should be developed. If you didn't, you shouldn't. You know, you really shouldn't. When these teachings are praised by the wise, they should be developed. When these teachings lead to unbinding and calm, do you feel these teachings lead to unbinding and calm? They should be developed. What do you think, Kalamas? When the defilements do not arise in a person, is this not for their long-term welfare and happiness, and for others' long-term welfare or happiness? Of course it is.
Yeah.
For everyone's long-term welfare and happiness, blessed one. And this person, free of the defilements, does not kill living beings or take what is not given or take another spouse. This is how we know. Or lie or induce others to lie. So what do you think? Are these qualities skillful or shameless? Are these qualities skillful, shameless, and praised by the wise? They are, sir. When developed and acted on, they bring long-term welfare and happiness to oneself and others. Now, Kalamas, one who follows the Dhamma, free of greed, aversion, or deluded thinking, alert and mindful of the path, experiences their life imbued with goodwill. Everywhere they go, their mindfulness is imbued with goodwill, with gratitude, and with a mind resting in equanimity. They are abundant and free from all agitation towards themselves and all humanity. Beautiful words, huh? When one follows the Eightfold Path, free from greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, undefiled and pure, there are four qualities they naturally develop. They will give rise to pleasant experiences in the present. They will give rise to pleasant experiences in the future. If harm is done with no intention, no suffering will ever touch them. If they remain harmless, then they can know that they are pure and no suffering will touch them. These are the four qualities naturally developed in one free of the defilements from following the Dhamma. The assembled respond, "Great teacher, you have shown a way to those who were lost. Through clear reasoning, you have made the Dhamma clear and taught us how to know a true Dhamma. We take refuge in you, great teacher, and in your Dhamma and in your Sangha. Please remember that from this day forward that we have taken refuge." We've done a pretty good job taking refuge, haven't we? Thank you for an incredible retreat.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.